Hi, guys. My name is Jay Newton Small. I am a Washington contributor to Time Magazine and author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. I'm sort of pinch-hitting here because the panel's been shaken up a little bit, and so I'm going to be your improvised thought leader. And instead, Doreen is actually going to be one of our panelists who was originally the thought leader. Stepping in for Yasmin is actually Sue, who's here, and then Mary Ellen. So I'm going to let them all introduce themselves in a minute, but I just wanted to sort of set the stage here a little bit before we begin our discussion, which I'm actually really excited to learn from these ladies about because they're all such great experts. When I was writing my book, and my book actually looks at critical mass, and so what happens when women reach a tipping point, somewhere between 20 and 30% in any body, whether it's a legislature or a corporate board, a Navy ship or an appellate court, and how they really begin to change the feel of that room. But I think what we're going to look at here today is actually more about what it's like to be in a room that's below critical mass. So, right, when you're one of the very few women in the room, and what it feels like to be surrounded by men, and how do you make yourself heard? Because clearly you're already going to stand out. You're already kind of the odd duck out, right? Like you're already, people know you're not one of the guys. You're not really, you're already abnormal. And so a lot of the women that I spoke to when I was writing my book talked a lot about how, you know, they kept their heads down, especially in the beginning, because they didn't want to be considered different. They didn't want to be singled out for attention any more than they already naturally were. And then they realized slowly that in keeping their heads down, they were actually doing themselves a disservice. And so, for example, one of the first chapter I have in my book, I write about the women of the West Wing and how they really felt left out of the West Wing. They, you know, especially in the beginning of the Obama administration, they weren't listened to. They didn't have an impact in a lot of the policies that they were trying to affect, and things got so bad that at the end of November in 2009 they had a very contentious dinner in the residence with President Obama, complaining to him about how they were being completely left out. And he basically said to them, guys, you got to step it up. You got to step up your game. And a lot of the women refused to do what they saw the men doing, which what they called it moths to a flame. And so the men would follow the president around like little puppies. and every time the president would walk, you know, to the car, they would just assume they were going to sit in the limo with him. And every time the president would go somewhere, they would just follow him around. And the women were like, why would I, first of all, personally, I wouldn't want to be someone, you know, I wouldn't want people to follow me around all the time. So they didn't follow the president around. And they just kind of kept their distance, you know, sat in the staff vans. They let the president do his thing. And they, you know, during meetings, all the men would sit at the table and all the women would stand on the side because they were just like, I don't need to sit at the table. This is like not, you know, I don't let other people sit at the table because that's what women do, right? And they ultimately realized that they were wrong to put their heads down and to be so unnoticed because it was undermining their ability to actually do their jobs. And so Carol Browner, who was then the environment czar, kind of gave this little pep talk to them and said, you know, you all are very powerful women, but every single time you leap up when a man says, why don't we get copies of something? Or why don't we get some coffee? Or why don't we get some water? And the women always leap up and say, I'll get it, because you just want to smooth things over. You just want to be like, it's okay, I'll fix everything, right? You undermine yourself and your credibility with the men in the room, and you essentially make yourself invisible because then they discount you as essentially a secretary and they won't listen to your ideas. And so the women started to kind of get together and form a cabal and back each other up and say, no, don't get coffee, don't get water, and maybe it is okay to sometimes be a moth to the flame with the president and take a seat in the limo and to sit with him, you know, and to sit at the table in the meetings. And they finally kind of all got together. And in this case, they actually did have critical mass. They made up 39% of the West Wing. And ultimately, there were two women, Nancy Ann DeParle and Alyssa Mastromonaco, who became deputy chiefs of staff, which essentially runs the White House under the chief of staff. And they started passing all kinds of new rules saying, only people germane to the meeting can sit at the table, and that includes you men. So even if it's a meeting about how birth control makes you feel, no, Jean Sperling, you cannot sit at the table. This is only for the people who are germane to the conversation, and that would be essentially in this kind of conversation only women. And it really changed the ethic and the culture of the White House. And in that sense, it was a nice story because they reached critical mass and they got each other's backs, and it really worked out. But until you get to that point, until you get to critical mass, there's a lot of strategies that you can employ to stand out, to stand out in good ways, not in bad ways. And like, and so here we have our expert panel to discuss this. So I'm just going to let them each introduce themselves, like a couple sentences, and then we're just going to launch the conversation. And everyone start thinking of questions, because I'd love to get the audience involved. And at the end, we're going to bring you guys in. So let's start off with Doreen.
Thank you. Just about me, I've run several businesses in my career, Frog, all in the innovation and design space. Currently, right now, I have started a company called Vidlet, which does mobile ethnography, which will play into what I'll talk about, because it's all about insights and empathy. And I also just started a new program at the University of Texas called the Center for Integrated Design, where we're integrating design thinking as a core fundamental into the whole university, which really is teaching students about empathy, teaching students about human-centered elements. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Very cool. Mary Ellen?
Hi, I'm Mary Ellen Dugan. I'm currently the Chief Marketing Officer of WP Engine here in Austin. And as I was kind of reflecting on this panel, I realized that I have worked for companies with under 1,000 people, for 10,000 people, and 100,000, and not necessarily in that order. And so it's been really interesting to see just this topic, how it plays out in different sized companies, different industries, the tech startup, and et cetera. So I'm not a native Austinian or Austinite. I never figure out what that is. Mm-hmm. I've been here about 4 years and lived about 15 plus years in New York City. So I don't think that geography necessarily plays a role in some of this. I think it's just inherent throughout business. So excited to be here.
Sue.
And I am Sue Schick, happy to be subbing today for Yasmeen Winkler. I am Chief Growth Officer for United Healthcare Community and State, which is about a $40 billion segment of United Healthcare. We're thrilled to be here as a sponsor. And I have been in health benefits for 30 years, and I think back to your kickoff and the comments about mistakes women make when they're in the minority. I started out in a training class, one of three women out of 30, and made a lot of those same mistakes. Hid, didn't speak up, really wasn't noticed. And fast forward 30 years later, my job, right before this job, I was CEO of United Healthcare of Pennsylvania. And I'd done many things in my career. I was the chair of the Pennsylvania Commission for Women. And again, I walk into a CEO council, 30 men, three women, 30 years later. Although in this time, two of the three women never showed up. So it was usually just me and the other 27 men. And it's interesting to see how much I had learned and how I had figured out a better way to navigate that space.
So I want to start the conversation with Doreen, who's written a lot about women showing emotion in the workplace. Yeah. And I just want to get you to talk about what your research shows.
Yeah. Thank you. One comment. It's just, and we're not young. I'll say it.
No.
That we're still.
Oh, you said that. No.
I'm sort of young.
You're young. Yeah. But I just, like, we're still having this conversation.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
I had this conversation 30 years ago.
Right.
And we're still having this conversation.
Right.
So ladies, all out there, in 30 years, let's not have this conversation anymore, okay? Can we make a pack on that, really?
Yeah.
It's shocking. Okay, back to emotion. So I kind of always look back. People always ask me these questions about how did you get there? How do you do this? And I think back to my career. In my career, everybody always told me I was emotional. Mm-hmm. What did that mean? I didn't cry in the workplace. I never got angry. I never got hysterical. But yet, people would write, and this is how it hurt, it's the best boss I ever had. She was terrific. And so I started really doing my own research and found that the skill that I had was empathy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't sympathy, it wasn't hysteria, it was empathy. And so it was really understanding people at a very deep level, and I took the time. Mm-hmm. And what I started to then go out and do my research and look around and found that that was absolutely a skill not taught anywhere. Mm-hmm. It was not taught in business school. It was not taught in medical school up until a little while ago. And what I began to realize was it was looked upon as a soft skill. It was something that wasn't worthwhile, yet when practiced, there were more successful companies and leaders. And when you look at the hallmarks of what a successful leader was, they all had that skill. Mm-hmm. And so I began to look at, okay, what are those businesses? Where is it? You know, we look at very successful, you know, I live in the design world, right? That's an empathetic driven mm-hmm. business. Successful businesses, we all have, you know, how many of you have iPhones? Empathetic driven business, right? You fall in love with something because it's made for a particular user. And so from a leadership perspective, the more I feel that women understand in particular how valuable that skill is that they are innately have. Everybody can learn this skill, but women have it innately. Develop the better leaders. And we all know, research has showed us too, right? Mm-hmm. Women are, in fact, women-led businesses are far more successful. So what does that tell us? And for me, that's what's been, and that's the message I've been, you know, for the last 5 years or so, I write and speak extensively about, because I think we, as women, have to not listen to that noise anymore around us.
So one of the stories that I that was in my book that I was told was Christine Gregoire, who was governor of Washington State. The first big press conference she gave when she was governor after all the recalls and everything else she gave, her dog had died the day before. And a reporter asked her about her dog dying, and she burst into tears. And she was so mortified at herself. She locked herself in her office for the rest of the afternoon. She was so angry. She was like, there's no crying in politics. It's like, you just can't do it. And she was, like, destroyed that she showed emotion, that she was weak. And at the end of the week, weekly, they do weekly polling, they found this huge bump. Yeah. She, like, got a huge bump in the polling because people thought it was an authentic moment. People really loved that she was being genuine. And there were moments where you can actually sometimes show emotion. But is that true for business, Mary?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about this, and I kind of have two quick stories. One is, you know, because you always hear this, don't cry at work, right? You know, that's, like, just the worst thing you do. And I can remember my father saying, whatever you do, don't cry at work. And I remember I had just gotten hired to run a consulting practice at a brand firm. And we go to this big presentation, and it is a disaster. I've probably been there maybe a month. And this is in New York City, so it's in Connecticut. And we have to take a three-hour car ride back with everybody in the room. So the managing director's in there. In fact, the CEO of the company says, this is a disaster. And I've been there like 3 weeks. You know, I've just been hired. So we get back in the car. We know it's a disaster. And the managing director turns to me and says, well, what do you think? And I do this. I'm crying. And I'm looking out the window just crying. And now we have 3 hours to go. And it was, you know, very awkward. There's three women behind us just like, oh, man, this is going to be a long 3 hours. But what I would say what I learned from that was I went home that weekend, came in, and I really reflected. And actually, the problem in the presentation wasn't my work. It was that the strategy was bad. So I had a really candid conversation with the managing director. And I said, here it is. I've got a lot to learn. I think I have a lot to offer. But I think fundamentally we're not strategically right. And to this day, 4 years after that particular thing, he is still a mentor, was still referenced at my current job. And we forged. He never brought it up again. And it was a professional way. So I guess I would say sometimes you can cry. It happens. And then the other is really to empathy. And many years later, I was running a pretty big organization, about 100 people. And there was a pretty big layoff and a reorganization. And those are tough decisions that you have to get through as a leader. And you have to handle them in a professional way. And I remember presenting to the group, and rather than, I didn't want to apologize for the people that unfortunately we had to let go, but I do remember getting choked up and saying, please be professional for those that are leaving. And sometimes when people are fired or let go or a death in a family, we tend to retreat. We don't talk to those people, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know what to say. And so I said, please just be empathetic and respect these people that who've spent their years here at the company. And a woman who'd been at the company 20 years came up to me and said, I've never had one of our senior leaders actually choke up and care enough mm-hmm. about the people. So those are just two quick examples. You got to be who you are, and if you do cry or you're empathetic, I totally agree. It's been hugely valuable as a leader for me.
Well, and Sue, you're a female leader. You're a female executive. What is your unique, I guess, female style here, and is it different, do you think, from?
Well, I love this conversation about empathy and authenticity, because I talked about the mistakes I made early in my career and how I could really make a difference later in my career is when I stopped trying to be like a man. Like, you know, like, duh, hello. You know, early in my career, I thought, well, wait a minute, I'll just watch those other 27 guys and do what they do. And it wasn't probably, I would say, it's probably been the last 10 years when I have realized, and I think it's really, UnitedHealthcare has really encouraged me to say, you know what? You know, they hired me for me, the authentic me. They want compassion. They want rapport. And in fact, you know, now I look at our leadership team at UnitedHealthcare, 2/3 of the leaders are women, which is stunning. And why? It's because we're in a human-centered business where empathy and authenticity, compassion, really matters. And I feel like it's only been like in the last 10 years when I stopped trying to be something I wasn't and I could step in to be myself.
So Harvard Business School studied women in their classrooms because they were failing to recruit enough women. And one of the things they did to study how women are being heard is that they videotaped the classes. Mm-hmm. And they found that because 50% of your grade is class participation, male professors were not giving credit to the female students or coming up with ideas because they would only hear the idea when a male student repeated the idea later on, right? And so videotaping the classes enabled them to see who actually had the idea first. How do you guys make yourselves heard in those rooms? Do you want to start, Doreen?
It's funny that you mentioned that, because that has happened to me in board meetings and other meetings. And for a while, you know, when I was younger, I would sit there and go, that was my idea, you know, and somebody else would take. And then I just started calling them out on it. Politely, you know, not being arrogant, but just calling them out. And it's really interesting. It's like pushing the bully. You know, when you catch him in a lie, and what are they going to do, start arguing with you? Oh, yeah, you did have that idea, usually is what I got. And so I think part of it is just being, you know, you said it's like true and honest to who you are as a person and not being afraid to stand up. I think the assumption is that, and it still is in a lot of male-dominated businesses, that women will not stand up for themselves, or they're there because we needed to get that equal opportunity, so we put a few women here. Stand up.
I'd love to hear, has that happened to you guys?
Yeah. I hear the head going.
And you know what else has happened to me, which I hate even more, is when a man says an idea that I had, but I didn't raise my hand and offer it. Has that ever happened to you guys too?
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, I think about this CEO council and, like, what I did to distinguish myself in this group, where many times, I'm with the CEO of Comcast and the CEO of Pfizer, you know, many times I would speak first because I knew there were a lot of good ideas in that room, but I had good ideas, too. And so the worst thing that, you know, someone might take a credit for my idea, and they may not hear me, but you know what? If I don't speak first and if I don't throw that idea out there, then I have no chance.
I agree with all that. I think one of the other things, too, is I'm a firm believer that if you take the time to listen, you're going to be heard.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes in our fervor to jump in and make a point, we don't take the time to listen and say, well, how much do I know about what is going on? And just become masterful at hearing what the conversation is. And spinning it back in a way that says, you said this, and you said this, and here's how I sum it up. I think that, for me, is really the key. Great. Listen to it, and you have to synthesize it in a way that makes sense.
Well, and so you have experience in tech and startups. I mean, what are some challenges that are unique to women in this space, and when we're talking about standing out?
Well, I think it's interesting. I now work for a company, WP Engine. 60% of our leadership are women. The CEO is a woman. The CFO is a woman. I'm a woman. You didn't know that. Our head of engineering. So I think that WP Engine as a tech company is somewhat of an anomaly. I will say one of the challenges I think in startups and tech is that there is this desire to invent something new. And so I think that's just kind of the nature of, you know, we want to be the first to market, we want to do things. So I think sometimes in startups, you've got so many things going on that culture and leadership and just women issue or men issue or day-to-day issues are just things you can't get to. So I think if you're in a startup, in a tech firm, you have to be aware of that, that it actually may be more challenging because there's so much more going on and we're trying to invent the new way of doing things. Vice versa to a more established company, I think sometimes bigger companies can spend more time on women issues and leadership. So it's very exciting to be in a startup in tech, and you're defining the culture, and you're actually defining what leadership's going to be. But it can be challenging.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and Sue, you said earlier that your career really flourished when you stopped trying to emulate men, right? Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is, does the established career ladder still exist for women?
Yeah, I would say no. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, when I started at like a million years ago, because we're old, we made that point, right? You know, it was, right, it was.
Seasoned, we're
yeah,
seasoned.
Yeah, sorry, there you go. It was more predictable. And now I would say I really have opened myself up to opportunities, mm-hmm. you know, and it's the, you know, the right. jungle gym, right? Jungle gym. You know, you're sure. jump, you know, you're going sideways. Sometimes you're taking a step backwards to move forward. And so it's really being open to those opportunities and not imagining in my mind what's next. You know, the current job that I'm in, I loved my CEO job. I had so much more work left to do that I could have stayed in that job for 5 years or more. My boss came to me and said, no, we want you to go move into this national job. And he had to talk me into it. I was like, you know, really? You want me to go do this other thing? But I love this. And by being open to maybe a sideways or kind of a lateral move, I've learned so much. I've learned so much. I've built so many relationships, which I think will take me further faster mm-hmm. Than if I had stayed in my previous job.
So one of the things that I learned from the women in the West Wing was that when you're in the White House, it's like drinking from a fire hose of information. I mean, there's so much going on. You're running the world, essentially. And men will speak up on 20% information, maybe. Yeah. Like, they're totally comfortable doing that. Like, I remember I had one time where I was talking to Carol Browner again, and she talked about being in the cabinet, and she used to spend 2 days, like, really preparing for yeah. what she was going to say in cabinet meetings. And she, you know, one day Bill Clinton was running late, as he always does, and she was asked, talking to two of her male colleagues, and she was saying, how long did you guys prepare for this cabinet meeting? And they were like, I don't know, like 10 minutes. She was like appalled that she'd spent 2 days preparing for this cabinet meeting. And so one of the things the women in the West Wing really had to overcome was feeling confident and comfortable speaking on less information. So being able to say, here's my perspective I think my perspective is important, even if I don't know like 100% information. Did you guys struggle with this, and how did you overcome it?
See, I think we can't look at the perspective that because they only studied at 20%, and a lot of men do that, mm-hmm. that's the right way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's what we as women have tried to, you talked about it, like emulate them in. Mm-hmm. I think being knowledgeable, you brought up a really good point, right. Mariela, of listening, mm-hmm. taking in all this
being
information,
prepared.
Getting your knowledge, actually being prepared. Maybe there needs to be a little bit of a change that goes on.
Yeah.
And people are more prepared and they do have more knowledge. I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's more of where we should go. It's like, okay, you know, men bring some qualities, women bring some qualities. You kind of, there's that give and take in the middle. It's not one better than the other. So that's where I think as you, again, be in those situations, it's learning, it's like, I don't know that that's the best way to do it, just shooting off at your mouth constantly.
Sure.
And I think it might be the definition of preparation. So mm-hmm. I think one of the things in being heard is being knowledgeable in your subject matter. Mm-hmm. So I think that if you're very knowledgeable in what you're going to present, or you're going into a meeting, or you've done your homework, doesn't mm-hmm. mean you spent 3 days, but you have that, then you're comfortable making a quick soundbite. And I uh-huh. think, unfortunately, in today's business world and media world, it is that soundbite. It is that very quick. And, you know, I've had a media trainer once that said, if you prepare more than 15 minutes for an interview, it's too much. And his point was, you've got to know what you're talking about before you walk in the room. And that's preparation. It doesn't mean that I went, you know, I spent 3 days. So I think maybe we have to redefine our word of preparation.
So that's so true that like you, the 30% Club has a couple of studies that actually shows that when women reach more than 30% on corporate boards, men actually have to show up more prepared for the corporate board meetings.
I love that. Yeah.
Because they lag behind the women. So, I mean, absolutely true.
That's awesome. You should see our leadership team meetings. Everyone's prepared.
So what are some of the bigger challenges that you overcame? I'll start with Sue here. In your own career that you feel are good lessons here for these young women?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of challenges, especially as I think about it, you know, insurance, which became then healthcare, right? You know, my career changed. You know, as a little girl, I didn't dream about going into insurance, but it's a fantastic field, and especially now with this focus on healthcare, you know, my focus on healthcare. But it has been male-dominated, and so this is one of my most significant challenges is standing out and getting noticed and not hiding my light under a bushel, which I did for many years by trying to be a man. I would say, you know, one of the ways that I overcame that is, you know, we talk about career path and there's no longer an established career path, is I wrote a career plan for myself. For so long, I thought, and I've seen many of my women friends do this, well, if I just work hard and I get good results and I add value, I'll get noticed, I'll move ahead in my career. And that worked for many years, but then it stopped working. And it wasn't until I sat down and got very clear, what do I want to do? And I actually wrote on a piece of paper, I want to be a CEO. I said it out loud. I wrote it down. I made a plan. I went to my boss and said, what do I need to do? What are the skills I need to learn? I set a time frame. And it wasn't until I did that that actually I felt like I could move ahead and move through that obstacle.
Real?
Very similar. My husband reminds me all the time and even sent me a text before this that I said years and years ago before we were dating, I said, I don't care if you sell bananas, but I'm going to be a CMO. And so I do think that I now regret that statement. No, he doesn't sell bananas. Yeah. He sells apples. I think for me, it's one of the things that I've had to overcome and I still have to overcome is that I think for me as a woman, or maybe it's just me, I can tend to take things personally in comments or constructive criticism, and then my go-to response becomes almost defensive, and you know, defending who I am, you know, my point of view and whatever. And so, a really good piece of advice, and I know we just had the election, so I'm not going to who you voted for, but one of the best pieces of advice I did see Hillary Clinton speak years ago, and somebody asked, "How do you get over all the personal attacks?" Mm-hmm. And this was way before the election. And she said, "You know what? You have to acknowledge that these things have been said, but you can't take them personally." So one piece of advice that I try to do in meetings is if it's getting rough or someone doesn't like my point of view or something, I literally use those words. I hear you, I understand, got your point, but I don't take it personally. And I try, and even just saying, acknowledging that you recognize those were said allows me to not take it personally and kind of put it in another box. So that's just, I don't know if it's a woman thing or not. It's certainly a Mary Ellen trait. And so just acknowledging other people's point of views, whether they're different from me, and not taking it personally is something as a leader I think is crucial.
I'm writing that down. That's a good one.
I know.
That's good. Dory?
You know, I for the longest time, I worried about me, you know, trying to climb whatever ladder there was. I don't know, because I didn't have a career plan at all. I still don't. I keep ending up in interesting
positions.
Neither does
the Mount Clooney, apparently, right?
But what I began to learn is I got that if I built a successful team, if I invested in the people around me, that raised us all up. And so that became almost a passion, or it's almost an obsession of mine, right? Which is investing in the people around me and looking at this more as the team dynamic. And of course, at the end of the day, somebody's got to say yes or no, right? Mm-hmm. There's always a final say, but there's a respect and you build up this team. And interesting enough, as you build up this team, your success rises with that. And people are less, men or women, to question you because you've got a whole team of people that have worked towards this goal. It's not you alone with your opinion. And for me, that was probably the biggest lesson that I learned.
There's a great Catalyst and Harvard Business School study where they looked at one class of graduates and followed them, and they found that surprisingly, that women and men both promoted themselves equally, but that men had, like, when they promoted themselves and said, hey, I'd be great for this vice president's job, that they had an echo chamber of five other guys standing behind them being like, yeah, this guy's going to be awesome. You should totally give him the job. But then when women stood up and said, I should get this vice president's job, she had no one standing behind her. And the men thought, man, she's really pushy. And so she didn't get the job. And so there's such an importance for teams and mentors and finding the right mentors. Did you find that this was true for your careers? And did you find mentors who would help you along the way?
Whoever. Yeah, I mean, this is critical, and one of the mistakes I made early on was I didn't ask for help. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, I think mentor is like a big word with a capital M. It doesn't have to be that. It can be a series of people who help you, a series of people that you just say, hey, can I buy you a cup of coffee? They don't even know that they're a mentor to you. They're just offering help. You know, again, like I think back to this CEO, you know, group that I participated in. A big way that I broke into that group was I befriended a guy. And I would say, like, how do I get into this group? How do I get the CEO of Comcast to listen to me? I'm new to Philadelphia. I haven't lived there before. And he, in a series of, like, you know, three lunches, I think I had to buy him three steaks, but, you know, maybe three martinis. But he gave me the secrets. He told me exactly what to do. And then he cultivated, you know, a group of men who then would support me when I had an idea, when I had an opinion. So I think that's really true. But it started with me not being afraid to ask for help.
Yeah, I think you have to look out to, I think it's, for me, it's been hard to find, to formally have a mentor, but I can look back in my career of people that plucked me out to do different things, and that was really important, and asking for help and asking for to challenges. My general thing, and it's a plea, I guess, to everyone, I think women are so much tougher on other women than men are tough on men. And so one of the things, I think, as you go through your career, I think early in your career, you have a lot of friends in the company and your colleagues and whatever, and that changes. Then you have professional, professional colleagues that you have. Right. But one thing for me, I have kept a very strong group of just women friends, girlfriends, and boy, they tell you how it is. And so sometimes I think, don't always look inside the company for that advice from women or mentors. Look outside, because sometimes people will be much more honest, whether you want it or not. But I think that's, and women, please be nice to other women. We're tough.
I agree with that. I mean, I never had a formal mentor. I had a lot of great people along the way. And so I have a rule of thumb in the morning. Every day I'm going to try to help somebody every day with whatever I could do. And so whether it's talking to students or somebody or giving recommendations, I feel that, and it's always a lot of women, and but I'm also happy to help men. But I feel like every day I do my part, the universe works in strange ways, and people will do that. And so I just, you know, it's about giving back. You know, I think we're all sitting here. We're very fortunate women. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what you have to do.
I'm going to take the sort of moderator's prerogative and ask two more questions. But if you guys have questions, can you start lining up at the two microphones here? And we're going to get to you after the next two questions. So start lining up there. So my second to last question is, any tips for your younger self? Anything that you would go back and do differently if you were starting out your career? Jump in, anyone who wants to go first.
For me, I would say I wish I had acted as if. So, like, I go back to that training class, and even if I didn't feel confident, even if I didn't feel prepared or ready, I could have made the choice to just act that way, to hold myself more confidently, to pretend I had more confidence than I did, because I think I would have grown into it faster rather than feeling more withdrawing at that point in time.
I hopefully am an eternal optimist, so I'm going to say that I don't know that I would have done a whole lot of things different, although I'm sure there's some. I think one thing, there's a great quote from Mark Twain, and it says, comparison is the death of joy.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
good.
I think that I, through my career, and now as I have younger people on my team, they're constantly comparing, I should have that manager title, I should have this title, I should have that. And you get caught up in that, and you don't spend the time enjoying the work that you're doing and the position you are. And just stop comparing. I would have stopped comparing myself to other people and other companies and just spent more time enjoying.
I think I kind of subscribe to what you... I don't know about looking back. It's hard to look back. I will... But I'm going to come out on the positive. All of those walls that I hit, and I splat. I was flat out a lot of times, were really good. Yeah. You know, I learned so much. Yeah. I think I never use that F word, failure, because I think we're in... I don't use the F word. Because I think... that we're in a constant learning mode, and if we're never in that learning mode, and we're always, right. I mean, we're all in that learning, you're all in that learning mode, that's a good thing, and you're going to evolve, and sometimes those really painful experiences, as long as you learn from it, and you set, we all talked about setting a goal of where you're going to go, that's what's going to get you to that next level, and then you feel really good about it when you accomplish it, right?
Well, and so along those lines, my last question is, what are three tips or two tips or ideas that you draw from your own success that you might give to these women today that helped you out in your, on your way up? I'm going to start with you, Doreen.
Be kind. Be kind. Definitely support the sisterhood. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's you know, that's truly a big thing.
There's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women.
Don't go there. It's a bad week. And but in that respect is really take the time to listen, to understand people, to know that we're not all made up to be the same, and that's a good thing. And if you take the time to understand and know that I inherently believe every single employee I had wanted to do the best job that they can. And maybe they weren't in the right position, maybe, but understanding that nobody wants to go into, especially in professional careers, nobody wants to go into a job and be terrible at it. And understanding that and knowing what you can do as a leader to help them, I think that's really been something very, very much that I've learned doing this.
Mary Ellen? I guess my two pearls of wisdom, is that what this supposed to be? Okay.
Three.
Wow.
Two or three. Two or three.
I'm going to go with two.
One,
there's
two
people
or three.
Standing. I would say, and I learned this later in my career, is really hone in on your strengths and play to your strengths. Stop trying to correct all the things you might not be that great at. You know, there's a line, and one of the guys in town, Roy Spence, runs an agency or started an agency, said, you know, be great at what you're really great at. Stop trying to be great at what you're good at. And so if you're great at presenting or you're great at analytics or you're great at communicating, go for it and become the best you can be at that. And then surround yourself with other people things you're not so good at, that they can help you. And then the other tidbit is I once worked for a man, and he was the first leader who ever admitted he had made a mistake and actually would change his mind if you know, if something had really gone awry. And it was most leaders tend to dig their heels in and say, well, I made that decision, so we're going to go for it. And so I felt that it's something I've now tried to embody. I think it shows confidence and it's authentic and just be honest of, hey, I thought I made the right decision, or we made the right decision, and own it. So those are my two things. Be great at what you're really great at, and own any of your mistakes.
So 3, 2, 1, I'll just put an exclamation point on a comment earlier.
Wait a second.
I like it. I like it. No, it's the countdown, right? It's the countdown to questions is, for me, I really didn't start making progress until I started being myself, until I really was authentic. And I'm always polishing, and I'm always trying to learn and get better. So I always, you know, I don't feel like I've arrived, but I'm trying to be true to myself. And I really feel like that has contributed to so much of my success in the last decade.
Great. Well, now we're going to open up to questions. I'm going to start on this side. Okay. Go ahead. No. Try it again. No.
Just shout out.
Personal relationships, which means a lot of times the guys will maybe go walk campus with them for lunch or whatever. I don't want to look like I'm sleeping around or whatever it is. I walk campus with my boss every day. That's the perception I'm going to give of myself. So I want to kind of balance those personal relationships and not looking like you're sleeping around.
Any advice? Did everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you have to reframe it for yourself. Even saying that, I have a lot of, you know, I've been married for 30 years. I have a tremendous amount of male friends that I do a lot of things with. That's okay. And so I think you have to reframe it for yourself and how you view that situation, mm-hmm. because otherwise you're stalling yourself, you know, because authentically, if you go back to what Sue is saying, it's like, just be yourself.
Yeah. And they are talking about business.
Yeah, of course they are.
They are talking, you know, and you know that. You know they're talking about business. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did a story for The Atlantic about women lobbyists in Washington. And what the women lobbyists did was they, and this I think helps when you start to get critical mass, is that they started doing mani-pedis with female members of Congress and with female members of the administration. And it started to become a really hot ticket in town because they started getting a lot of work done over mani-pedis instead of golfing. And then the male members started asking to get invited to the mani-pedis. And so you had like Eric Cantor pouring champagne for like, you know, female lobbyists. And so as they were getting their mani-pedis. And so I think that there's, you know, perhaps, and I don't know if there's not enough high-powered women to do this, but even if it's not within your company, within like the area or the like mm-hmm. the sort of tech arena, start to getting together a group of women, you know, who like start doing mani-pedis or whatever it is that is your activity that is authentically you, and enjoy it, and have your own conversations. And that's, I guess, the best advice I can have.
Yeah.
Over here now.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my name is Monique, and I am a university student, and I just want to thank y'all for being here and sharing your experiences. I would like to ask, so we learn through mistakes and learning experiences that may not have gone our way. Are there any specific learning experiences that you think like acted as a wake-up call or maybe really shaped the way you are now?
I think they happen every day. I mean, you know, you talked a little bit about the tech industry. A year and a half ago, I meant to see a very well-known VC, in fact, often mentioned in the show Silicon Valley. And I had known him for about 15 years, and he invited me for lunch, and we sat there talking, and he kept talking about money and how they wanted to get me involved. I was like, okay, this is interesting. And then he leaned over at lunch, and he said to me, "Now, Doreen, you got to stop this woman thing, because I write a lot about women. Because it's going to give you a bad rap, and it's going to hurt your career." And I thought to myself, at this stage? So I was hoping to retire. I was hoping to hoping to have more of a career. So I guess what, you know, the part of that for me when I listen to that is, they're all going to help you define the next step for yourself. Embrace it, right? Learn mm-hmm. from it. Every time you feel like you've made that mistake, take a moment. What mm-hmm. did I learn from this? I mean, that's probably what I didn't do when I was younger, but I think, mm-hmm. you know, for me, that's what I do now as I reflect, and that's what I did mm-hmm. after that lunch. It's like, huh?
Right. I
would just say that I think failure is uncomfortable, and sometimes I find people make a move too quickly after something bad has happened in a company or not gone the way that you want. You didn't get the promotion, a project didn't go as well. And there is, I think, in today's just workplace, it's okay to move on, and you don't really get dinged a lot if you're leaving a job on a rapid basis. But I would just, I would encourage you that, you know, learn from those. Don't always make a quick move and say, "Oh, I failed, so I have to move on." Sometimes failure's okay to stay, and you're gonna learn from that. And I think, you know, in a social media environment, we want to like everything, and we want to like everybody, and that's just not how work sometimes is. Sometimes you just have to go through the good, the bad, and the ugly, and spending a couple years there and working through that, you'll come out much richer in the end.
So the only thing I would add is, and it's not my story, it's because I'm a journalist, I tell other people's stories, but this is Patty Murray, who's the senator from Washington mm-hmm. State, told me a great story about how when she first was elected to the Senate, they were debating the Family Medical Leave Act, and she went to the floor of the Senate and gave this speech about a friend of hers whose son was dying of cancer, and he took off work for 6 months to nurse his son through the end of his life. And he lost his job and nearly bankrupted his family. And that was, on a very personal level, why she felt it was important that the Senate pass this bill that would allow people to take family medical leave in case of emergencies and still have their jobs to go back to after that. And she was leaving the Senate floor, and an older male senator, Bobby Byrd, came up to her and said, "We don't tell stories here. This is not a place where you tell. This is the Senate floor. This is a place of decorum. You tell." He's like, "You talk about data. You talk about empirical evidence." And he's like, "We don't tell personal stories here." And she just looked at him and said, "Well, you may do it that way, but I do it differently. And I'm going to tell my stories here." Mm-hmm. And so sometimes your way of doing things mm-hmm. might be different, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong. And it's worthwhile trying to do it that way. Good and point. Years later, Bobby Byrd came to her and said, "You're so right. It's so much more powerful to tell stories on the Senate floor." and in the end of his life, he's told many stories, crying, in fact, about, you know, things about on the Senate floor. So,
good point.
Thank you.
Good.
Oh, hi.
It's working.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. I work at a large tech company, and I recently got promoted into a management role, which is exciting. But yeah, it's Yasmin, right? Yasmin?
Sue.
Where am I getting Yasmin from?
She replaced Yasmin on the panel.
Well, no one can replace
Yasmin. Okay, sorry. I got here a little bit late. I'm
really delighted to be here.
Sorry. anyway, I just got... This is... Okay. I just got promoted to a management role. Very excited about it. I just had a quarterly review with my manager, and he's like, "You know, you're doing a great job. You're performing well. You know, all that stuff that's just kind of table stakes in sales." But he kind of said that I need to do a little bit more around like visibility and self-promotion, stuff that I'm sort of uncomfortable with. Like, not because I'm not confident, but because like no one likes it when other people are like, "Oh, look at me," you know. So I was wondering if the three of you had any advice about kind of like how to like, self-promote and I guess get more visibility to upper management without looking like I'm a self-aggrandizing jerk.
Anyone want to take that?
Some of that makes me think of it. It's also a reframing opportunity
that's what I'm thinking.
You know, and I did this for many years, and sometimes I still do it, that I think, "Oh, no one wants to hear how great I am." But, you know, people do want to hear success, right? So there's a way to do it. There's a way to talk about the value that you added or the results that you got. Sometimes I'll even send other people to tell that story on my behalf, which, you know, could be easier depending on the circumstance. But I also have a lot more confidence to share those stories today. And you know why? I've reframed it in my mind from "I'm bragging" to "people can learn from this. This can help other people. They can see what I did that added value or got success." And so it's not to be afraid of it or not to think of it as bragging or, you know, good girls don't, you know, talk about themselves, whatever it might be. It would be you're cheating people if you don't share your success and reframing it that you're actually helping other people in that regard.
I think this is a common problem, male and female. It's hard to not come across that you're bragging or you're arrogant. And so one of the advice I give to new managers is it's not about you, it's about your team. Mm-hmm. So phrase it in the way that is, "I'm really excited this quarter. We had this objective and we did this." And call out people that work for you or with you. Or it's you will get the accolades by bringing those stories out, and it won't feel uncomfortable that it was me saying it. So tell the story from the standpoint of the team you're on or the team you're with.
And you'll learn, this is a moment in time when you think back on someone that helped you, because this manager is trying to help you. They see your potential, and they're trying to, you know, without spoon feeding it to you, they're trying to get you there. So take that as something and run with it.
That's good advice. Thank you.
Feedback. Yeah.
Over here.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I own an electrical, air conditioning, refrigeration, and plumbing company. And with this, I sit on a board that is an Air Conditioning Contractors of America, mm-hmm. all men.
Good
so
for you.
I like to dress up in heels and a dress. That is who I am. So when I went to the conference, they're all in their jeans and their boots and their button-down shirts, and they laughed. They were, look who's coming, right? So they made a little joke, and I heard it, and I acted like nothing, and I went through the whole board meeting, and every time I would try to say something or discuss the air conditioning situations that we're having and some sort of solutions to the problems, they literally shut me up. Like, they even talked over me. It still burns in me. And I have to go back. What do I do? Do I not go? I feel like it's a waste of my time. I don't want to waste my time, but it's my industry. It's my passion, so... What do I do?
You have to go.
Well, you have to confront them. Yeah. Again, and you guys jump in. I keep jumping in. But it's the bully in the room, right? They can do that. They're ganging up.
Right.
It's herd mentality. Now, there are sometimes females do this, but males tend to do this a little bit more. It's that herd mentality. And you sometimes have to be louder and bigger and stand up and call them out, every single one of them.
And it's like slamming your hand on a table.
Not slamming your hand, it's standing up. When that's happening, you're burning inside. Take that energy outward and call them out in a very calm way mm-hmm. on how juvenile and unprofessional they are. And then blog about it.
Yeah.
If all else fails. And then get out on social media and make them look like fools. It will stop. But you have to, at this point, you have to take control. You're ceding your control, and that's what's really making you angry.
Yes. Yeah. I would say the exact same thing. I love the blogging. That's a total bonus. I think you get this question a lot on what you wear and what your fashion and style is. And I think your style is your style. Mm-hmm. And so my personal opinion is you don't want to be... you should be as comfortable as you are, and I wouldn't change that. And if this is a board meeting, this is not your business. This is a part of, I mean, you're doing a variety of things with this. I would set an objective of what you want to accomplish in every meeting you go to and not try to boil the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to take time to get these guys to see the businesswoman that you are and the executive. So I would set a very specific plan of, I'm going to make two comments. I want to get this data point across. And when you hit those two, I'm done, I'm wearing my dress, and I'm coming back next week. Because don't try and boil the ocean. And that's just an advice in general. When you're in a very cantankerous situation or visceral, you have to just say, it's these two things, or one thing, or three, whatever is comfortable. And once you've done that, you move on and live to fight another day. And you'll wear them down, I feel certain.
Thank you.
And beautiful dress. Yeah, there you go.
Hi, my name is Jasmine. I am in strategy and sales planning in a large tech company here in Austin. First of all, I wanted to say thank you to all the women in here and the women on the stage, especially in relation to how you guys have been so open about your experiences around being emotional and showing empathy at work. So I just want to share a quick story before I ask my question. I was really struggling with... this team aspect while I was at work a couple months ago, and I pulled one of the managers that was a mentor to me into a room, and as I was trying to get his advice and tell the story of what was going on, I found myself getting really emotional. And I don't know if this has happened to you guys, but once that trigger goes off, it's kind of like flood works, right? So then he used this incredible strategy of basically asking me questions, and I could say yes or no, and then he could deep dive into how I was answering those questions. And I had never seen that strategy before, even in my, 24 years as a woman. So I wanted to share that. If you guys ever have that kind of environment as you're leading other people. But related, and I thought, and I was like, well, this is a man manager, and he's doing such a great job in coaching me in this situation. And it made me realize that there are a lot of opportunities, especially as I'm growing in my career, to manage up. Because I think, in these sessions, we're learning a lot about how to manage down. But, maybe... you're having a first-time manager, maybe you've had a manager that's never managed a woman before, or maybe you've had a manager that has never managed a recent undergraduate student. So do you guys have any advice on how to manage up or share any experiences there?
Yeah, the first thing that I usually do with a new manager is try to understand their goals. What are their professional goals? What do they want to, you know, do they want to jump, you know, to be the CEO of the company? Do they want to jump, you know, three levels up? And then what are their personal goals? What's important to them? Because if I can understand that and what makes them tick, then I can help them be successful, which is back mm-hmm. to the team, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because they're on the team too. And when they shine, the rest of the team shines. And so that's something that's worked well for me, especially when I'm working with somebody new for the first time.
You know, and I think every new manager, you know, it's just normal. You're scared. It's insecurity. And so part of it is really understanding them and making them, you know, feel that, hey, there's somebody I can trust. You know, nobody's out to hurt them. Because there's, especially if you're a new manager, it's just scary.
I think the managing, I'm glad you brought that up. It's not something I had thought about for this in prepping for this session, but not a lot of preparation, just a little bit. I think that's really important, and we lose sight of it. Now, there are people that I feel manage up way too much sometimes, and I'm like, my goodness, you're just going above everybody's head all the time. But I do think it's a really important thing in your 24 years, I'm jealous, is pick a couple people, and it may be one a quarter. As you can see, I'm kind of a goal setter of like don't boil the ocean, but I do think getting to know people and having mm-hmm. an agenda. The last thing I have a lot of people that say I want to have a one-on-one with you, or I want to sit down, and they don't come in with an agenda, and that does drive me crazy. But if somebody comes in and says I'd like to learn from you, and it can be a couple levels up, I think that's really really important to we just lose track of that in the craziness of the day. So I really encourage you to you know, pick a few people you just want to meet over the year, and make sure you have a really solid conversation with them of why.
Okay, I think we have time one last question over here. And sorry, guys, we're at the end.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I work for a chemistry R&D group. We are about 8 people. I'm the only girl. Or woman, I guess I can say that now. So, Sue, you said that you don't need to become one of the guys, and it's mm-hmm. better if you just be yourself. But I feel like there's still this gap there. Like, yes, I can be myself, but whenever I walk into a joke, you know, they say it and it's hilarious, and then at the end they're like, don't tell HR, don't tell them. I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, cool, that's what you guys think of me, that's great. That I'm just like this frail lady that, you know, I can't laugh at your jokes. So I guess I'm saying, how do I bridge that gap?
Anyone?
I don't know if you, in your research, if you have a better example. You know, there were years when I would have tried to be one of the guys. And I'm just going to tell you, it didn't work for me. And it hasn't worked for a lot of my friends. And so now, if it's a funny joke, I laugh. And if it's not a funny joke, I don't laugh. And I say, you guys are being knuckleheads. You know, and it's being myself and really asserting myself and not trying to be like them, but also not trying to be, you know, something else, some idealized vision.
But did you still have, like, personal relationships with coworkers?
I have deeper, better relationships because I think that they knew that that wasn't me. You know, when I was trying to be one of the guys, they always knew, well, that's not the real Sue. And so it's funny because, like, my boss now, who plucked me from this job, we were peers 10 years ago. And, you know, he says, okay, now I finally get to see the real you. And he likes me better. Because, you know, you don't have to remember. You don't have to pretend. And I'm just saying that's what's worked for me. I don't know if you have a comment about the research or what you see, if
there's a... You know, she's in an interesting, you're in an interesting situation because there's 8 people in the company, right? So you're small and you feel alone and nobody wants to feel.
I mean, there's more people in the company, but these are
the people that you work with every day.
And you depend on each other.
Yeah. And you can be their peer without having them. You know, what they're thinking about right now is they have this, it sounds like to me, they have this vision of what they think you are. And they're treating you that way. And if you became who you really are and you acted like who you really are, slowly that would diminish. Because it sounds like they have they framed something about you. You know, they've had this picture of you. And you're like, oh, yeah, I'm not frail, and I'm this. Just be who you are. And sometimes it's okay to say, that's really inappropriate. Yeah. Like, shut up.
Yeah. Or I will call HR because you're a bunch of knuckleheads.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just
saving you for yourself, you know.
I would just add that for the women in the West Wing, what, you know, like Obama very famously plays basketball, golfs. He mm-hmm. never invites women to play basketball. He never invites women to golf. I think he did once because he had to, because people shamed him. And that's just not who he is. He likes to hang out with the guys. He's a guys guy. They throw footballs around the White House. And the women found that you just had to find your own way of developing your own relationships with them that didn't involve, mm-hmm. and the women who learn sports in order to relate to the president, oh, like, received.
I totally asked them to go out and get pedicures with me.
Yeah. and they're obviously, the president's probably not going to go get a pedicure and manicure with Valerie Jarrett, but like, but there are ways to form friendships with people, you mm-hmm. know, with men. And it has to be sometimes in a more kind of one-on-one setting. Like, you're not going to be able to, sometimes doing it in a group setting, like, all together at once is going to be very difficult. But, you know, for example, Susan Rice and Samantha Power are two of the president's favorite people to have dinner with. And he, because he's a total geek, and one of his favorite things on the planet is to talk about constitutional law. And, like, and they love talking about constitutional law with him, and so they have lots and lots of dinners where they sit and discuss the constitutionality of various different things going on in the world and in the government, which is just who they are. And, like, mm-hmm. and so they may not discuss, you know, the Cubs or the Bears with him, and they may not throw around a football, but arguably they have a better position to have his ear on policy because they have a very broad-ranging understanding of constitutional law that he really respects and loves to, like, you know, have long, whiny dinners with where, like, they can talk about this stuff. So, I mean, there's just different ways that you can find, like, commonality with people and form relationships.
Anything? That's great.
Okay. Well, I guess thank you so much to our amazing panel.
Good luck.
Great.